We have been 2 weeks in the Ante-Nicene Church. That's the church roughly from the period of 100 to 350-ish. 100 is kind of the end of the apostolic era, the first generation eyewitnesses to the miracles and ministry of Jesus. By the time we get to 100, it's presumed that we have no more first generation witnesses. John the Apostle, perhaps, was one of the last, if not the last, and we roughly estimate the date of the writing of Revelation to the last decade, 95, 96, perhaps, although opinions range pretty widely on that. But we get to 100, we're all, from there on, we're all just going based on what other people have said, based on the witnesses and testimonies of others that have gone before us. And so we start in 100, and we'll get to 350. 350 is the Council of Nicaea, which is on the agenda for next week. But that time period, we go 250 years of the Christian church growing and expanding within the Roman Empire. And as you're going to see tonight, most of that period was tumultuous for the church. It brought persecutions, martyrs, torture, challenges, both physically, all those we just mentioned, as well as in beliefs, which you talked about last week, heresies, false ideologies. So for 250 years, this went on. And again, when we think about the church being around for 2,000 years, 250 years doesn't seem like that long in the grand scheme of things. But again, 250 years is roughly the lifespan of the United States, 1776 to now. A long time. 250 years is a long time for the Christian church to live under persecution. Interestingly enough, you'll see one of the trends was the church, man, it would rile itself up and be geared to stand firm at all costs, and they would endure 2 or 3 year window of trial and persecution, and then that window would close, and then you'd have 30, 40 years of peace. And then a new wave of persecution would hit. And when it would hit, 40 years had passed. And so the Christian church had really kind of gotten used to being comfortable and happy and safe. And there was always a little buffer period in which, you know, a new wave of persecution would hit and you're going to be prosecuted unless you abandon your faith and denounce Christ. And there'd always be people who would. In fact, lots of people who would. And then those that didn't, that would stand firm, that would give their life, would kind of motivate and rally everybody else, and it would build, and the church would, it kind of went, it was very much a roller coaster. But it was in the days of comfort and peace and prosperity and security that the church kind of got lazy, kind of got weak. And then it took the examples of bold, faithful men and women standing up and paying the ultimate sacrifice that would build the church up again and strengthen it, and people would, you know, would be very, very committed and very faithful. And you just see this ebb and flow really all the way from, well, 60 AD to the reign of Constantine, which would come about 312, 313. Again, a period of about 250 years. So, two major sections tonight to look at in the Ante-Nicene Church 100. I said 350. It should be 325. Apologies. Two sections. One is just kind of what life in the early church looked like, and then secondly, you see Roman numeral 6 below that. We're going to look at the extension. We talked about persecutions in the second century 2 weeks ago. We're going to look at those persecutions beginning in the third century up until the reign of Constantine. So, early church life, first century churches. This is from the era of the apostles. We know by reading Acts, originally they met in the temple in Jerusalem, and whenever they began spreading out, the apostle Paul would always go to the synagogue in whatever city he happened to be at, and churches would meet in the synagogues. All that period in the first century where the Christian church was presumed to be under the umbrella of Judaism, they enjoyed not only protection from the Roman government, but they also had places to meet. The Jews would kind of let them meet in their facilities and their buildings. But as the church kept growing and becoming more and more Gentile and less Jewish, those opportunities that were extended to them began to dry up. And so towards the end of the first century, and especially moving into the second century, they had to start meeting in people's homes. And when they were under persecution, they would meet in secret locations. Within denominational Christianity today, there's always people saying, well, we shouldn't do this or we shouldn't do that. That's traditional. This is traditional. This is new. You know, we shouldn't have comfortable seats, or we shouldn't have pews, or we should have pews, and we shouldn't have stadium seats, or we shouldn't have cup holders in our chairs, or we shouldn't have, you know, piano, or shouldn't have organ, or we shouldn't have drums, or we, you know, everything except the house and the people that met there, and usually the Lord's Supper, everything came later. In other words, everything at some point was a newfangled addition to the church gathering communally for worship. There was a first time where they put a musical instrument in the church, a first time when they put a piano in, when they put an organ. There was a first time whenever they sang this song or sang that song. There was a first time whenever they actually had air conditioning in a church building. There was a first time whenever they had comfortable seating. There was all of those things. Originally, what was required was somebody's house that said, we can meet here, and a group of people that profess faith in Jesus, and we get together, and for the most part, they would share a meal. Most early Christian worship was built around the common meal and the Lord's Supper. And they would also talk about the writings of the apostles and encourage one another in living out the example set before them by the apostles. But the early church services were quite rustic compared to our secondary location here in the chapel at UBC. They didn't have baked chicken or Salisbury steak either, I don't think. I don't know. Usually each city only had one church. They didn't have to worry about denominations because there was just the Church of Rome and the Church of Carthage, the Church of Alexandria, and the Church of Ephesus. If you think about leaders, the apostles, as well as teachers and evangelists, sometimes those were used interchangeably, but they were leaders that were not locked into one church. They had regional influence. They had influence over lots of different churches, and it wasn't always the same region. You know, when we know a lot about the places where Paul's influence was, because we have all these letters, and they all have names in them, to the church at Ephesus, to the churches of Galatia, to the church of Philippi. But Paul wasn't the only apostle that had a regional influence. Peter did as well. It's just that we only have two letters that Peter wrote, and he didn't identify churches by name. But Peter traveled around probably an equally large area as Paul, connecting with different churches, sharing the testimony. John, much the same. We have letters written by John. James, the brother of Jesus, stayed in Jerusalem and kind of worked around the city of Jerusalem and the area there in Judea. The apostles were kind of regional leaders. Then within the individual churches, you have pastors, bishops, elders, and I should have put deacons there as well. But pastor, bishop, and elder were kind of used interchangeably. In other words, a pastor and a bishop was kind of the same thing, and he might even be an elder. The individual leader of a church community. Deacons were much more widespread, service-oriented. But every church would have a local leader, but also the influence of apostles that kind of traveled around. Worship, you see the last two notes there. Worship revolved around the ordinances of baptism and Lord's Supper. These, of course, were connected to Jewish practices of ritual cleansings and the Passover celebration. Worship also included the Lord's Prayer, benedictions, and singing of hymns. So, life in the first century church. If you recall from 2 weeks ago, there were a couple of instances of persecution with Nero, with Domitian, but those were pretty much localized in Rome. They really didn't expand to the entire empire. And so the church was able to grow and expand, you know, through the first century into the second century without a great deal of tumult. And a lot of that was because they were identified just as a sect of Judaism. As they began to get kicked out from under the umbrella of Judaism and identified as a separate religion, then different kinds of rules applied. The Jews always had exceptions made. The Romans learned early on that if we make the Jews do something they don't want to do, then we're going to have a big mess on our hands. The whole country's going to revolt, and we're going to have to send our army in there, and it's going to be bloody, and it's going to cost us a lot of money, and it's going to be a lot of trouble. And so a lot of concessions were made to the Jewish people, and that benefited the Christian church for a good while, until all of a sudden it didn't benefit them anymore. You think about that identity of the first century church compared to the church moving into the second and third centuries. As the church got larger, you couldn't have everybody just in one house church in every city. And so these cities started having multiple congregations meeting in different homes, different parts of the city. And that necessitated the identifying of a single leader who was the church leader in this city. When we talk about these people and they have the title bishop, usually bishop of Rome, bishop of Carthage, bishop of wherever else. If that's their title, then their position was the lead church official over the variety of congregations meeting within the city of Rome or wherever it was they happened to be. There would be a lead bishop, and he would have his congregation, and then every other congregation would have an elder that also operated as a bishop for that congregation. But the one lead would kind of be the chief bishop or primary bishop. You can see early on how this structure of leadership would eventually expand into what the Roman Catholic Church would use as kind of figures over, you know, regions and over cities and over churches, a top-down form of government. And early in the second century, the churches were just developing things out of necessity. You know, we're growing, we're multiplying like crazy. We don't really know what to do. So how do we make sure we have good leadership in all of these congregations? How do we make sure these heresies are not being taught? How do we make sure we're staying orthodox? And so they were doing the very best that they could. The third point there, because of the central location in the empire, starting in the second century, the Church of Rome began to grow in influence. Whoever was bishop of Rome, whoever had done ministry in the Church of Rome, it started to have more and more influence over the rest of the churches. There also became a concern with the church staying singular, unified, universal, and universal is what the word Catholic means. Catholic means the universal church. The concept of a Catholic church began to emerge. The purpose was to keep the church connected to the apostolic tradition and to safeguard it from heresies. With worship again, baptism was the primary ritual of joining the church. Interestingly enough, it was practiced in various ways, but predominantly done by immersion. How many of you bought this Gonzalez book? You have a copy of this. If you look through that chapter, it had a picture of what's believed to be one of the first churches where houses began to be converted. Page 110 is one, and then you have a baptistry in the ruins at Ephesus on 112. Two pictures that show baptistries. The church at Dura Europus, I believe, was 3rd century. The ruins in Ephesus, it says here, 5th century. But both of those baptistries look very similar to what we would do baptisms in today. Looks like a big bathtub or a sunken in, kind of walk down in area for baptism. And so a lot of times people, because the Roman Catholic Church eventually became the big Western influence in church, and because their practices of baptism was not immersion, we aren't always aware that early on, out of the apostolic era, most churches predominantly practiced baptism by immersion. They didn't all do that. There are plenty of other instances in early writings where a candidate would kneel and they would pour water over them, pouring baptism, sometimes referred to as baptism by effusion with an A. We have examples of those being practiced. ultimately what decided what kind of baptism you performed? Usually practicality, if you had water or not. If you were located by a river or by a lake, you'd go down to the river and baptize people. If you were in a facility or a structure where you could easily get water inside enough to dunk people, then you did. If you were located somewhere where water was, or during a time of year where water was not accessible, where you couldn't get to it, then we had to practice baptism by means that were a little bit more pragmatic, a little bit easier to accomplish. Later on, we would begin to dig our heels in over whether we sprinkle or pour or dunk. But early on, it was predominantly immersion unless the circumstances necessitated something else. And the church seemed to have this flexibility that said, well, if this is the, we prefer to do it this way, but if we can't do it this way, then there are other ways of expressing one's symbolic spiritual cleansing from sin by their testimony of following God. So, yes. Ooh, where did the bishop get his education? Typically, it was passed down, and I didn't put it in my notes, but I think there may be just casual mention to it in the book, but the passing down of the apostolic tradition was the way that they communicated the passing down of authority, and so they wanted to make sure that with the line of bishops, that we can trace these line of bishops back in their training and their teaching all the way back to Peter or Paul or John or James or one of the apostles. And so it was kind of an apprenticeship style, but if I'm going to be the next bishop, if you're the current bishop and I'm going to be the next bishop, then I need to be learning from you, because you learn from the bishop before you, that keeps that string going all the way back to the apostles. The importance of apostolic succession was very important. So, baptism was primary ritual of joining the church. By the way, in the second and third century, how often did they do baptisms in the church? Anybody know? Once a year, usually. At Easter. Once a year at Easter. If you came and expressed a desire to become a part of the church, in the first century, most of those people were Jews. Well, a lot of them were Jews. But in that environment, it was presumed that if you're coming from Judaism into Christianity, then you already know a lot about God, His character, His laws, the ethics of God's people. You already know a lot of that stuff. And so they would move from confession to baptism pretty quick. But as the church starts getting more and more Gentile, and we're bringing people in from Roman pagan religion instead of Judaism, it was no longer presumed that these new people have any idea what we as Christians believe. And so there was usually a period, sometimes a year, sometimes up to 3 years, in which a person who had expressed a desire to become a member of the church would be referenced as a catechumen or a catechumenate, and they would have to go through new member class for up to 3 years before they would be permitted to be baptized. They had to go through training and understand what the doctrines and beliefs of the church were, exemplify in their life that they were following Jesus before they would baptize them. Once you were baptized, you were a member of the church community. It may seem a little bit harsh. There were a lot more stringent rules, and that stringency is going to come into play later on, before people could come into the church. But if you lived, it's really not that different than underground church culture in parts of the world where the church is highly persecuted. If there are all kinds of people out there that are anti-church and would love to sneak in under the guise of being committed to the church in order to rat you all out and get you persecuted by the local government, we might be a little bit more, cut and dry before we let people in. We want to make sure that you really are professing to follow Jesus and living that life before you're granted full rights and privileges of becoming a church member. Lastly, the Lord's Supper or the communal meal was the central component of the weekly worship service. And it was this way for a long time. Today, really the sermon is usually the central part of our worship service, and everything kind of flows around that. But those first three centuries of life in the church, lunch was the central part of the worship service. And so there's a little bit for us as Baptists that we can kind of, you know, the potluck meal. It's biblical, right? It goes back to the beginning. That's our apostolic succession, you know. Yeah. But they would get together, and it was normally what they would do is they would meet and they would have kind of a reading of the apostles' letters or the teachings of the New Testament. They would encourage one another. They would talk about what it means, kind of like we would do maybe in a small group Bible study. And then those who had not been baptized were excused, and then they would have the Lord's Supper. And they did it as often as they met. In most cases, they would do it every week. So those of you that come from traditions where you would do communion every week, that also, much like Baptist potluck, the weekly communion goes back to early church tradition. It was never mandated, but that was the way it was practiced in a lot of cases. And it was in a lot of ways for practical reasons as well. The church would be taking care of widows, would be taking care of their church members that didn't have anything. For some of them, they may only get to eat a handful of times a week. And so the communal meal that they shared together on the first day of the week was a way that they took care of one another, that they shared what they had with everybody else that was a part of their church community. Not only just sacrament, but also ministry of generosity and care for one another. My aunt. That doesn't happen very often. So early church life, that's not every element. The book talks about a variety of other things, but that kind of touches on location and leadership and worship. Anything else about life in the early church? I think for us, one of the most important things, we live in an era in which tradition has become something we cling to, whether we meet in a bowling alley or we meet in a sanctuary or we meet in people's houses, what songs we sing, what clothes we wear, what kind of chairs we sit in. Tradition becomes very entrenched in the life of the early church. And if you go back to those first 2 and 3 centuries, what worked usually determined. They didn't have any tradition. And so they practiced things based on what worked in order to allow them as a community of believers to meet together, to share life together, to take care of one another, to encourage one another, to testify to others. And so I think sometimes the pragmatic view of the Christian life in worship and service, they got it really good. Sometimes we just do things, whether it's effective or whether it works, we do it because that's what we've always done. And there's always a challenge within our history for us to not to abandon tradition. We should be informed by our tradition and many things in the way we do things. You see, baptism, I mean, that's something that's tradition that goes all the way back to the first century church, to John the Baptist. Taking the Lord's Supper, you know, that goes all the way back to Jesus and the disciples. But we should always be looking at our traditions to see if they are indeed helping us accomplish the purpose of the church, or if all they serve to accomplish is satisfy our traditional comforts. That's always a challenge, but it's good for me to see in those early churches, they didn't have a lot of luxuries, they didn't have limitless resources, and so they just used what they had. Meet in our homes, share meals together. Be the body of Christ. Be the church. So, any questions or thoughts about other aspects of life in the early church or anything that I mentioned? Yeah, John. The Catholic Church performing an ecumenical service on Sundays. I don't know, but some of you may have more. Yeah, Mass is usually on Saturday, and then ecumenical, like a teaching service or a... Okay, communion, gotcha. Yeah. I think they do, yeah, every week. Now, you don't have to take it every week, it's optional, but they do offer it every week. The Lutheran Church, I believe, I'm sorry? Episcopal Church does it weekly. I think there are some Lutheran churches that do it weekly as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's a lot of criticism about why they do it that way, but people have no idea that this is why. And even their church structure is based
Yeah. I think, you know, her comment was, growing up as Episcopalian, you see, and I think hopefully even as Baptists, or if you didn't grow up Baptist, you grew up in some other tradition, thinking about these things, you ought to see where most of our traditions have roots, you know, but they all, as the family tree gets bigger, the branches get to be a little bit more scattered and, you know, tangled and confused, and it's just a product of being a 2,000-year-old religion that, you know, different communities have emphasized certain traditions over others, and sometimes practices that once were very pragmatic and very effective, as culture changes, cease to be pragmatic and effective, but we keep doing them just for the sake of tradition. And there's a whole lot of, you know, I hear more and more critique of the institutional church. You guys hear that or recognize what that is? People love Christianity, and I just want to be a follower of Jesus, but I don't want to be a part of the institutional church. I don't want to be a part of an organized church. And I'm like, well, A, I understand where you're coming from, but B, church is a body of believers. That's what church is. It's plural. It's ecclesia is plural, the ones that are called. And so, but it can be that we can, if we're not careful, let the church become much more of an institution than it is a community, much more of an organization than it is a family.
Well, my point was actually the opposite of that.
Which was?
You don't need to be critical of
right.
it because it does serve
yeah.
a purpose.
Yeah.
And that sometimes it's not just for the sake of tradition.
Right. Well, and I think that it's well put, is that tradition it's meaningful to people always, because you have people that grew up in that tradition, and so it's meaningful for them. Baptists are usually not very good at being ecumenical. That's why I got confused with your choice of words there, John. Baptists are not very good at being ecumenical. I don't know that many denominations are good at being ecumenical, but what ecumenical really to me is knowing my own tradition and my own practice of faith, but valuing those of other traditions, even though I don't do it, but valuing it because I recognize it has meaning to them, and that it's not anti-Christian. It's just a different understanding or a different practice that's rooted somewhere in our history for some purpose. Yes, sir. Yes, before they were baptized, they had to, yeah, in a lot of cases, it was much more exhaustive than what we ask people to do. You know, when I baptize people, I'll ask them to confess Jesus is my Lord and Savior. I don't know at what point the Apostles' Creed kind of came in. I think that's later. But even in these second and third centuries, the catechumens had to go through a period of training, and they had to be able to state, this is what Christianity is, this is what I believe. And so it may be a little bit more akin to what we do with deacon ordination, you know, that there's a question and an answer, and you have to be able to speak with an orthodox system of beliefs to testify before you can be baptized into the membership of the church. Yeah, the incense, and that goes back to the Old Testament. Yeah, burning of incense in the temple. So it all comes from somewhere. Whether it's beneficial is always a good question, but it all comes from somewhere. Yeah.
When did the church embrace the first day of the week?
When did the church embrace the first day of the week? That happened during the apostolic era. In fact, I think it may even be mentioned in Acts that they were meeting on the first day. Is it not mentioned in Acts?
Yes. It's misconstrued.
Is it? Yeah. Early church writings, early church fathers, early on in the second century, speak frequently about the church meeting on the first day of the week as a testimony to the resurrection. And so if it wasn't soon after the resurrection of Jesus, I mean within 10, 20 years, they were doing that before the end of the first century.
What day was
that? That'd be our Sunday. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. The significance of it was that it was not Saturday. It was not Sabbath. The Jews continued to meet on Sabbath or continued to recognize Sabbath, but these Messianic followers, even within Judaism, and so in many cases, they would still recognize Sabbath, and then gather together with other Christians on the next day for worship on the first day of the week. And so, yeah, whatever the specifics are, the part of the significance is the first day of the week was not Sabbath. Perhaps. I haven't read that or heard it, but again, there's all kinds of practical reasons why the church did things that it did, along with spiritual and symbolic reasons. So, third century persecutions. After a period of relative peace, persecutions against Christians in the Roman Empire resumed around 202. And would continue to varying degrees until Constantine's reign began in 306, and really the signing of the Edict of Milan, which I think was 313. Some key names: Septimius Severus ruled 193 to 211. He looked around Rome and he saw crumbling empire. Threats from barbarians trying to invade on the edges. Economy was down. People had abandoned the customs, their patriotism, and their religion. And Severus looked at all of this and said, "We are being punished because of our laziness in giving reverence to the Roman gods." And so, While he would become somewhat brutal and anti-Christian, it wasn't because he was a bad leader politically. He was pro-Rome. And he looked around and said, his interpretation of their circumstances was, our poor religion has led to the gods abandoning us. Therefore, we need to bone up on our Roman worship. And so in 202... His method was to do it a little bit more peaceably. What he did was he said, "We're going to bring all religions from all over the empire, whatever your system of beliefs are, we're going to let you continue worshiping as long as you acknowledge that your religion comes underneath the worship of the unconquered sun, the God over all." It was kind of a Unitarian thing. He said, "All religions are just fine. They all point to the same place, and we're going to call that God who's over all of these systems of beliefs the unconquered Son. And you can worship, you can be a Christian, and you can be a Jew, and you can worship Roman gods, or you can worship Greek gods, or you can be a Hindu, or you can be a Buddhist, as long as you also will acknowledge Caesar as God and pay homage to the unconquered Son." Well, in all of the Roman Empire, if you think about it, if you're a Hindu, you already believe the God is manifested in thousands of different manifestations. This is not a problem to add one more. If you're Roman, then this is really not a problem. If you're Egyptian, I mean, worshiping the unconquered sun, perfect. That goes back, you know, all of our history. Two groups of people balked at this and kind of caused a ruckus. And those two groups would be Christians and Jews. Yeah. Christians and Jews. And so, in light of that, they began facing persecution because of their refusal to acknowledge the unconquered Son. Severus didn't really go out of his way to prosecute existing Christians and Jews, but he did make it illegal to convert to those two systems of belief. All right, we're not going to worry about the people that already are. That's going to cause a big mess. What we're going to do is just kind of stamp them out by making it illegal for new people to sign up. And so what you have during this window of time was not widespread persecution against existing Christians and Jews, but the Christian church was continuing to grow. And as people would convert, and as teachers or leaders or missionaries, evangelists, as they would encourage people to convert, those two groups of people did come under persecution at risk of life during the reign of Severus. You can be a Christian, just don't tell anybody, don't encourage anybody to become one, just keep your mouth shut and mind your own business and you'll be fine. would have been tempting, for sure. But there were many who were persecuted under that time period. The book talks about two women. They were a part of a group of five that converted to Christianity. Felicitas, I believe, was the name of the key, and Perpetua, I think, are the two. But five of them were arrested. They'd converted to Christianity. Felicitas and Perpetua were from a noble family, a more elite family. And so the government system went through a long process of trying to get them to recant, and they refused. And so first off, the three men were thrown into the arena with wild animals. And I think the story goes that two of them were destroyed immediately, but one of them, the animals wouldn't come near him. And he, after a while, made the declaration that he would die, that he would offer his life to his God, and that he would die by a leopard, specifically named the animal. And then a leopard attacked him and killed him. After the three men had been thrown in, the women were given one more chance to recant and abandon Christ, and they refused. And both of them went into the arena and were slaughtered by wild beasts. And so it kind of goes down in lore. They became heroes and heroines within the early church because converting to Christianity and then refusing to back out. So their stories are in the book, or you can look them up online if you'd like. So Severus was number one. Secondly, you see Decius Trajan. After Severus, I think he ends about 211, you have one of those 30-year, 40-year windows I told you about where you had peaceful, you know, existence, and the church kind of got lazy and comfortable and life was good. And then 249, a new emperor comes to power, and he sees the exact same things that Severus did: economy in peril, invaders at the edges of our empire. We have abandoned the Roman gods. But instead of just allowing other people to worship whoever they wanted and give allegiance to the unconquered sun, Trajan said, everybody's going to worship the Roman gods. You're going to offer sacrifices to the Roman gods. And if you don't, then you're a traitor. You are guilty of treason to the Roman Empire. And so there was this system of certificates. You would go to a temple, you would offer a sacrifice to any of the Roman gods that happened to be represented there, and then they would give you a certificate. Put in your house, and you're good to go. And if you didn't have a certificate, then you roll in the dice. During this time period, Christians had lots of different responses. Some of them would just refuse and face persecution. Some of them would procure false certificates by some means or method and post those to protect themselves, even though they hadn't offered sacrifices to the pagan gods. Some would relent and offer sacrifices to the pagan gods, and then after a time, repent and want to come back and rejoin the Christian church. And then there were others who simply went into hiding during this time period. And so it was really interesting. And you see a problem is going to emerge. That the church, it's one of the first big issues the church, internal matters, the church has to deal with. We have people who suffered. By the way, Trajan usually didn't put Christians to death. He had seen what happens when we kill Christians. They become heroes and the church grows. He was much more interested in apostates. It was a victory for him if he could get a person to denounce Christ and leave the Christian church. And so they used torture much more than they did execution, trying to get people to abandon their faith and then send them back out there as apostates instead of killing them and making them heroes. So now the church has this situation. After the persecutions of Trajan, the church has this situation. We have people that endured torture and refused to deny Christ. They're not martyrs because they didn't die, and so they gave them a new title. They called them confessors, because they clung to their confession through great trial and persecution. We have these people, and then we also have these people who bought false certificates and saved their hide and are still in the church. And then we have these people that actually offered sacrifices to the Roman gods and now are wanting to repent and come back. So how do we manage this? What do we do? It was the first big membership argument that we know about in the history of the church. You see there the end of Trajan. I think we kind of talked about all of that. These people that had offered sacrifices to the false gods were referred to as the lapsed. The lapsed. They weren't apostates because they were trying to come back to the church, but they were the backsliders, if you like good old preaching, the lapsed. And so the next two, C and D, are different leaders in different areas. Cyprian was bishop of the church in Carthage. That's North Africa. Novatian was not originally bishop. He was a leader in the church in Rome. But they handled this situation very differently. And it's while it's historically interesting, it's also, I mean, as Christians for us, I mean, how often do we try and deal with difference of opinions in how we manage circumstances that the Bible doesn't just come out and say, here's how you do it. The Bible didn't have a whole lot to say about what happens to the lapsed whenever they offer sacrifices to the Roman gods, and then they repent, and then they want to come back. And some people would say, well, Peter, Jesus let him come back in. And other people would say, well, but Judas, he didn't, and he went and hung himself. And so it depends on which disciple you want to use as your example. Depends on how you, as a leader in the church, might respond to this issue. Are these people Judases, or are they Peters? So the issue you'll see down a little ways was the purity of the church. We must maintain a pure church, and so if we have cowards or people that will abandon us that easily, we should make it really, 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 really hard for them to get back in. And then there were those that would say, well, the church is supposed to exemplify forgiveness and love. So, purity of the church, forgiving love. And you know what? If you follow the history of Christianity from then until now, you'll still find examples of the church trying to figure out how we maintain our purity and our identity, and how we practice forgiveness and love to people all around us. Listen, a lot of the big political issues that the church is dealing with today, this still goes on, right? Purity of the church versus forgiveness and love. How do we interact with criminals? How do we interact with addicts? How do we interact with people that have sexual lifestyles that we may not agree with? How do we interact with people that have differing views outside of Orthodox Christianity? How do we interact with people like that? And the church, I would suggest, is wrestling with this issue today the same way it has been for the better part of 2,000 years. Cyprian in Carthage, he fled persecution in order to continue guiding the church from safety, was accused of cowardice, but under a later period of persecution would become a martyr. Some in Carthage who had endured torture felt they should have authority to decide, and they were allowing return with little terms. Cyprian was advocating for stricter terms of restoration, but what he acknowledged was the church is the way we come to God. You cannot get to God except through the church, which is the body of Christ, through Jesus. And so he called a synod, a gathering of leaders, and they made these decisions. Those who had purchased false certificates would be readmitted immediately. Those who had sacrificed to Roman gods could be readmitted, but only either on their deathbeds or if another wave of persecution comes about and you have an opportunity to prove your faithfulness and loyalty to Christ. So you can get back in, just not today. Isn't that funny? You've probably heard sermons where preachers told people, now I know some of you are thinking you're going to wait till your deathbed and then you'll decide to become a follower of Jesus, and you never know when it might happen and you may not have the chance to do that. And then, 1,800 years ago, Cyprian was telling people, you can't come back to Jesus until you get to your deathbed, and then we'll let you back in. So as for authority to make these decisions, the bishop with a synod of elders had authority over splinter groups within the church. This was a rising of a splinter group, and they granted authority to the existing leadership. Novatian was in Rome. He felt like the bishop of Rome was allowing people in far too easily, and he advocated much stricter, much more stringent requirements in order for people to come back into the church. This created a schism in the church in Rome. It was the first church split. This group in the church doesn't like that pastor, and so we're going to go across the street and plant second the second church of Rome. We got the first church of Rome, now we got the second church of Rome. Because Cornelius was the forgiving love side of the equation, and Novatian was very much the purity of the church side of the equation, and they couldn't figure out how to mediate the two. And so the schism would last long past the deaths of Cornelius and Novatian. Both, by the way, were martyred. You see they're under Valerian, 257 to 59. So after that, after about another 40 years of peace, we get to round three for the third century, and it would be the worst, not only the third century, but probably the most severe and widespread persecution that the Christian church would face during the entirety of the Roman Empire. Diocletian was emperor. Diocletian's wife and daughter were Christians. And so he was favorably disposed towards Christians, but about this time, Rome was really working at keeping invaders out, trying to build up their military, and the Christian church couldn't decide if they should serve in the army or not. And so you had a lot of Christians that wouldn't. You had some who would get into the military and then would spread cowardice or pacifism and were causing problems. And so Galerius was a governor. They called him a Caesar at this point in the eastern part of the Roman Empire. And he was the one who really began to despise Christians because they were weakening his armies. He sends a letter to Diocletian about it. Diocletian says, you know what? We're going to issue an edict. All Christians are going to be removed from the military. No big deal, right? No other punishment. No deaths, no nothing. Just Christians don't serve in the army. Well, that gets back to Galerius, and in practice, it seems like no big deal. But you can imagine when you're the commander of a particular unit within your army, and you don't want to get smaller, you need to get bigger. You don't want to get weaker, you need to get stronger. You're going to use whatever influences you can to keep these Christians who might be leaving here. And so anything I can do to get you to recant your faith and keep you in the army, I'm going to do. And it led to the beginnings of a very widespread series of persecutions, not necessarily mandated by the emperor of Rome, but by this particular governor. As that began to happen, Christians were persecuted. Some would leave. They would face persecution just of a social variety within their homes. Several years later, during the same kind of reign of Diocletian and Galerius, Diocletian eventually mandated, now that's on the bottom, next page, in 303 he issued an edict that intensified all of these rules. Christians could no longer be in positions of civic responsibility. Homes that were used for church meetings were to be destroyed, and all Christian writings, including the Bible, including scriptures, were to be burned. And so it was not physical. It was a persecution of sorts, but it wasn't physical. A few years later, there was a couple of fires that were set, one in the emperor's own palace, I believe, and he blamed the Christians for retaliating against the Edict of 303. And that is when persecution went from stage one to stage two to stage three. And Christians all over the empire began suffering and dying and being martyred over the next 8 to 10 years. 311, sometime around 308, 309, I think, Diocletian was replaced as emperor by Galerius. In 311, Galerius became ill, severely ill, and there were Christians around that convinced him that the reason he'd become ill was because it was God paying him back for all of the persecutions he had extended to the Christian church. And so late in his life, after putting to death who knows how many Christians, Galerius decides it's time to relent. And he issues the Edict of Toleration in 311. Part of the Edict of Toleration, it pardoned all Christians who were in prison. It allowed Christians to continue practicing their faith and worshiping as they saw fit. And it also mandated that they should pray to their gods for the Roman Empire and for her emperor. And I think 5 days after he issued the edict, Galerius died from the disease, from the illness. Yeah, ultimately, they talk about your deathbed. I wouldn't say conversion, but his last attempt. So the Edict of Toleration is really important because the Edict of Toleration marks the end of, or the beginning of the end, of what was the most severe period of persecution in the history of the Christian church. In the Christian church during the Roman Empire. Edict of Toleration in 311. The next year, Constantine, who was a son of a former governor, was ruling as kind of governor in the region of Gaul, that would be France, and the British regions of the empire, marches on Rome in 312, captures the city, and this would begin a string of events that would lead him to becoming the total emperor of the Roman Empire in 312. In 313, and here's the story of Constantine. While he was coming up on Rome, the legend is that he had a vision, either a dream or a vision in the sky, that told him to put a symbol that was connected with the Christian church on the shields of all of his soldiers. It's what is referred to as the Chi Rho. It looks like a P with an X through the middle. Have any of you seen that? It's a very old Christian symbol. It's a Greek Chi and Rho for Christ. To put those on the shields of his soldiers and then march into battle. And so he did put them on all the shields of his soldiers, and they marched into Rome and defeated the sitting leader of the city and conquered the city. And so as a result of this, he was not a Christian. There'd be a conversion later on, but he was much more favorably disposed towards the Christian community than any Roman leader up to that point had ever been. And so within a year of his taking Rome, in 313, he goes and meets the primary leader of the eastern part of the empire. And they meet in Milan, the city in Italy, and he and they together conscript the Edict of Milan. And that, along with the Edict of Toleration, and the Edict of Toleration was the beginning of the end, the Edict of Milan in 313 specifically said there should be a cessation of all persecutions against Christians. Now, it's kind of like, the guys fighting on an island because they hadn't heard World War II is ended yet. Communication didn't get around real easily back then, and so there would be little pockets of persecution for the next 5 to 10 years after the edict was signed. But that was really a landmark moment in which legally the Roman government no longer supported or allowed persecutions against Christians. So you think about all these things just in summary. Persecution was a testimony which spawned growth. Tertullian, who we looked at a couple of weeks ago, made the comment that the blood of the martyrs became the seed of the church, that those men and women became heroes, and they encouraged others to great acts of faith and courage, and the church really did grow stronger and more numerous because of the sacrifices of faithful men and women. The persecutions caused division over what to do with the lapse. The church had to deal with its first internal controversies, not heresy, but administrative matters, membership matters. The persecution stimulated the writings of the apologists we looked at a couple of weeks ago. It elevated martyrdom and the confessors to a desirable state, which unfortunately produced some spontaneous martyrs, people trying to become martyrs and maybe succeeding in dying, but whether or not they succeeded in becoming martyrs, not necessarily. And then finally, it attracted the sympathy of certain officials who eventually stopped the persecutions. So 313, Edict of Milan. By the time we get to, I think, 325, we're going to see the Council of Nicaea, which is kind of the church, bishops and the church from all over the Roman Empire kind of coming together now that they can safely and saying, okay, now what are we going to talk about? How we believe, how we practice, who are we as the church? Up until this point, the church had been very pocketed, sporadic, functioning loosely unified, but very much on its own in different parts of the world. The councils that we'll talk about next week kind of start trying to bring some unity to churches as they're scattered all over the Roman world. But the anti-Nicene period really is, it's a period of marked persecution, but also incredible growth. And so hopefully you'll kind of be able to hang on to that in your mind. And if you haven't got to read through Gonzales or whatever else you may be reading, feel free to do that. Or if you're not reading a book, just go Wikipedia, Trajan. or go do a Wikipedia on Perpetua and read some of those stories. It's pretty good stuff. So, any questions or comments before we wrap up? So, in the book, the material, if you're reading after the fact, the material for tonight really was chapters 10, 11, and 12 in the Gonzalez book. And so, the outline we have for the course doesn't run exactly with the chapters in the book. And so, the next 2 weeks are councils and then Constantine. So, Constantine is 13. I would read chapter 17, which is the Arian controversy and the Council of Nicaea. And I would read 17 and 18 for next week if you're reading along. But 17 and 18, and then the week after will be Constantine up to that point.